I'm Cassandra Abedili. I go by Cassie. I'm with an Amherst alum of the class of 1996. We're actually sitting in my apartment right now. I'm sitting with Kate Murphy. Which class are you?
83.
Kate and is the author of, most recently, Scoundrels in Law. And let me get the entire title because it's a great title. Scoundrels in Law, The Trials of Howe and Hummel, Lawyers to the Gangsters, Cops, Starlets, and Rakes Who Made the Gilded Age. And prior to that, Kate is author of the book Crazy 08, and that is another exciting title. Crazy 08, How a Cast of Cranks, Rogues, Boneheads, and Magnets created the greatest year in baseball history. As I said, Kate is an Amherst alum. She's also former writer for The Economist. She's former editorial page editor of the Asian Wall Street Journal. And are you currently at Fortune magazine?
No, I'm currently working as an editor at McKinsey.
So formerly assistant managing editor of Fortune magazine. I am currently assistant district attorney. That, I guess, is why they asked me to speak with you, given the fact that your book involves a criminal defense firm from the turn of the century. I have to tell you that reading your book, it's been a blast. It's been so much fun because it really did seem the story of the attorneys who are precursors to so many of the guys I work against or with these days. And you noted that, and I was listening to one of your interviews about how they really were the first, I guess, celebrity attorneys.
Yeah, that's certainly the way I look at it. Howe and Hummel, they thrived between about 1870 and 1900. So post-Civil War era, it's really the era of the first mass media in the country in the form of penny newspapers. It was the era of the first tabloids. So you think of newspapers like the New York World and the New York Journal. And then as now, what sells tabloid newspapers? Crime and sex. And Howe and Hummel had a heavy investment in both.
Howe seems like, I mean, physically he was a larger-than-life character, as you describe. But he also seems like he was such a showman. And I think one of the things I found in my own career is that, you know, you don't have to be the brightest to be the best trial lawyer. But you have to be well-researched, you have to be very prepared, and you have to be likable. Juries have to like you. And I think, and maybe you can comment on that, because he really did seem the character that had all of that and was incredibly charismatic.
Yeah, totally. I mean, even the people that Howe beat, which would have been your colleagues, district attorneys and ADAs and prosecutors, they all seemed to have a not-so-sneaking affection for him. A number of his rivals, a guy named Arthur Train, Francis Wellman, who had been district attorneys in New York, wrote memoirs after they retired. Each of them had an entire chapter about Howe, and each of them noted that they lost this guy on a regular basis. They knew he lied and cheated, and yet you just feel the affection coming through the pages a century later. So there clearly was a sort of bonhomie to the guy. William Howe, he wasn't tall, but he was about 300 pounds, loved to dress, loved diamonds, purple waistcoats, very much a showman. You think of these guys you see showing up on things like court TV today, I mean, he would have been one of them in a heartbeat. And I really think he was actually the precursor. He cultivated the press. He was always good for a quote. You know, he created this persona for himself. And he would have been, I describe him sometimes as a combination of Johnny Cochran and Rumpel of the Bailey.
And then Hummel, Abe Hummel seemed like a very different character.
Totally. Like any great partnership, you know, study and contrast. So, you know, Howe is tall and fat, and this great showman, and he, you know, dresses outrageously. Hummel isn't even 5 feet. He's thin. He dresses in black. Howe is Catholic. Hummel is Jewish. There is absolutely no evidence that the ethical traditions of either religion influenced them in any way, shape, or form. So they couldn't have looked more opposite. But they clearly had a very very good working relationship and also a real friendship. And Hummel, Howe was the senior partner. They got together when Hummel was 13. He had left school at a young age, as most New Yorkers did back then. And he joined the he came to Howe's law office in 1866, I think. Anyway, and as an office boy, like, you know, sweeping up floors or the like. And a few years later, before he could even vote, he was a full partner. Oh, wow. So something happened there. I've always wanted to know. I mean, how do you become a full partner with this guy before you can even vote when you start as a sweeper-upper?
And back in the day, law school wasn't required, right? You could apprentice?
You could apprentice. Laws varied by state. But in New York, all you needed to do was to be 21, male, and you know, pass suitable examinations. And you could do that however you wanted. So neither of Howe was born in England. He might have gone had some kind of formal legal training there. But Hummel's legal training was sweeping up around the Howe's law offices, which is probably as good legal training as anyone else had in those days.
Which is interesting to me because I got the impression that Hummel was sort of the brains. He was the legal scholar, if there was one in that partnership. And you wouldn't think, you know, the guy sweeping up would ultimately go on to be that guy.
He was clearly a very sharp guy, and he later became a recognized expert in matrimonial law. He was sort of the divorce lawyer for Broadway, which kept him busy. And he was also one of the early experts in theatrical law. So he actually really helped to break new ground in areas like copyright and theatrical contracts. So he, you know, he clearly wasn't just a sweeper-upper, and I think your impression is absolutely right. He was more detail-oriented than Howe. Howe's great moment would come in the closing argument. Hummel didn't have that sense of theatrics. He didn't have that courtroom presence. So he was more of the sort of behind-the-scenes guy. And again, in a good partnership, you want contrast, and they clearly work that way.
And I think in a good legal firm or legal organization, you need that. I mean, you need to play to your strengths and know your weaknesses.
Right. Yeah, it's in fact, after Howe dies in 1902, the criminal practice drops off precipitously as Hummel, you know, basically turns the firm into more of a civil practice, which is where his strengths clearly were. Mm-hmm.
I was absolutely fascinated. You started to mention something that reminded me that I definitely wanted to talk to you about this. One of the things that I loved about this book, and we started talking a little bit when you first walked in today, and unfortunately this wasn't recorded, but I thought the stories obviously spoke for themselves. The characters are incredible. But it's such an incredibly well-researched book, yet it flows, and it's witty, and it's quick, and your sense of humor clearly came through. There was a line, and I'm going to pull it up in a sec, but there was a line I absolutely fell in love with when talking about Marm.
Marm Mandelbaum.
Yeah,
Marm fabulous. Mandelbaum. Entrepreneur of crime. She was a German immigrant, came to New York, and she became New York's leading receiver of stolen goods. Everyone knew Marm Mandelbaum, and she operated openly for almost a quarter of a century, which says as much about New York and New York policing at the time as it does about Marm. I say that if she was alive today, you know, she'd be running Wall Street, but career opportunities were limited for women, so she became a fence.
And you know, fencing is still huge today, and people are running warehouses. She did it first. I mean, the total amount of money was what that she
Well,
fenced?
You know, of course it's a guess, but right. I think they guessed up to something like $10 million over 20 years. So she was, and she was a client of Howe and Hummel, of course.
And she paid for others to be their client, right?
Absolutely. But she, you know, she really did look at her job as a kind of career. So she, you know, she had employees, she had proteges, she took developing the next generation of management very seriously. And once she found someone that she liked and trusted, if that person got in trouble with the law, she would bail them out and pay for Howe and Hummel in order to keep that person's services down the line. So she certainly thought long term.
I think there was a phrase in here that was used, and her establishment was known as, she ran the Bureau for the Prevention of Conviction.
Yes.
I absolutely love that phrase.
And you a prosecutor. Yeah. Yes. But, you know, again, you can see the woman's, you know, the woman has management issues, which is, if you're running a big network of stolen goods, you know, finding people that you can trust and who are good at the job, it really it's very, very important. So once she found someone, she sort of invested in that person.
Which made sense, because as you come, as you say over and over in the book, there's no honor among thieves. And ultimately, yeah. I mean, the Wyos were a good example.
Yes. A number of people listening to this have probably seen the movie Gangs of New York, or maybe even read the book. The terrible movie, totally inaccurate book, but, you know, but fun in some ways. But the Wyos were one of the Irish gangs in New York City in the 19th century. And they thrived, if that's the word, starting a little before the Civil War, and then they ended in the 1880s. You know, I'm of Irish descent myself. I have absolutely no sympathy for the Irish gangs of New York, and I think any idea to romanticize them is a really bad one. You know, like gangs, you know, throughout history and down to the current day, what the Wyos did was they preyed on their own people. You know, it was Irish shopkeepers and saloon keepers and Irish women that were pimped out, and they're just a nasty, nasty bunch of folk. They found their end in the 1880s when four leaders in a row were convicted of murder. Three of those people were Howe and Hummel clients. So they clearly didn't work all their magic with the Wyos, but I talk in the book about each of the cases, and they were pretty hopeless. I mean, in one case, the Wyo was found, you know, literally standing over his victim with the smoke coming out of the gun. There wasn't really a lot you could do. Interestingly, the fourth Wyo, who was convicted of murder, not defended by Howe and Hummel, they were initially asked to defend him. The guy didn't take his advice. But the larger problem was that he had left his murder victim almost literally on Howe and Hummel's doorstep. It was about three paces away. So my legal advice for gang leaders who want a lawyer is to not leave your murder victims on their doorstep.
I mean, you would essentially defeat one of Howe's great arguments, because at the time, you needed the body to convict on for homicide, right?
Yes, I'm sure you did. Yeah, I don't think you
don't
could
anymore.
Have done. Right. But obviously things like, you know, forensics and so on are so much more sophisticated now. In fact, sure. That's actually one of the interesting things about writing the book. So you think of the period of Howe and Hummel's glory, if that's the word, 1870 to 1900. It's also a period in which the New York City Police Department got so much better at what it did. One of the early murders in which Howe and Hummel were involved was that of the financier, a guy named Benjamin Nathan. Mm-hmm. It was a classic locked room mystery, and Benjamin Nathan was actually the uncle of Benjamin Cardozo, the great Supreme Court jurist.
So Cardozo's all over this. Between his bad dad.
Isn't that amazing?
I was fascinated by that.
But the police investigation of the Nathan murder, which is, you know, the big murder in 1871, you know, all over the newspapers, it's an absolute pig's breakfast. They just get nothing right. By the 1900s, it's much more sophisticated. They're doing chemical analysis of blood, for example, in a classic chopped trunk mystery. So that's actually it's one of the interesting sort of currents, I think, that runs through the books.
I had a question about, 'cause there was that image of the, you know, the duck, I think, sitting in the blood pool.
Right.
In one of the stories. Was that the Nathan homicide, or was that a different...
No, that's the other end. That's the Willie Golden Soup.
Golden Soup.
And
right.
And that was the case where they actually, you know, took up... what happened was this loving couple decided to get rid of the third point of the triangle by luring him to a house in Queens, but it was then very rural area. And then they stabbed, dismembered, shot, and then disposed of the body in several different hunks. The man was truly and completely dead. Unfortunately, the several times over, the torso showed up only 15 minutes or so after it was dunked in the East River, and the whole plot fell apart pretty quickly. In part because of the newspapers. I mean, can you imagine what the tabloids would do with a story like this today? Well, they did the exact same thing back in 19, This was 1897, 1898. The newspapers were all over the story, and they actually did some very good investigative work, but so did the police. You know, they were able to track down the sheet in which the torso was encased. They pulled up the drains and saw that there was blood down it. They were able to do chemical analysis to verify that the blood was human. It was the kind of stuff that 20 years before your, you know, plot on the beat would, you know, he probably would have just beaten up the next door neighbor and arrested him. The police work got much, much more efficient.
I was really surprised because of the timing. I was surprised at how sophisticated it was at that time. I have a question I wanted to talk to you about. That Howe and Hummel, as defense attorneys, were unscrupulous in certain ways, but on balance, they were zealously advocating, right? And that's the defense attorney's job in our sort of, in our system, is to zealously advocate for a client. Whereas as a prosecutor, my job is substantial justice. And I think Howe crossed the line. I mean, in so many ways, bribing, fake affidavits, but little things like supplying a defendant's wife with a child to sit on her lap for the trial. Isn't that just clever?
Sure, because, you know, he never actually says, well, you know, that baby belongs to that woman who's the wife or whoever. I mean, let the juror draw his own conclusion. And it just shows that there's an interesting synergy between the specialties and the practice. Hummel, as you remember, was the lawyer who specialized in Broadway. And Howe was much more on the criminal side. So you could actually hire out-of-work actors and actresses to play certain roles in the courtroom for Howe. So this, you know, the whole idea of synergy and specialization was, they were pioneers of that too. So yes, I think that's zealous advocacy, but it does sometimes go over the line, not just ethically, but I think just in humane terms.
Yeah.
And the example I'm thinking of is there was a famous murder case in which a medical student was accused of filling a capsule with poison to kill.
Methadone, right? Methadone?
Morphine.
Morphine. Oh, yes,
right.
Morphine, yeah.
To kill his 18-year-old bride. The marriage wasn't real, and the mother was making them go through with it, and he didn't want to marry this woman for real. He had just gone through a sham version so he could sleep with her. But, you know, it's a tragic thing. I mean, the poor girl was 18.
It was a terrible story, but I was also fascinated. It's the same story I'm hearing about all the time.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. You know, again,
this is a slightly more creative way to kill somebody, but
right. And again, it also the sophistication of the crime. He took apart a capsule that was filled with quinine. He filled it with morphine. He gave his girlfriend, I think, six of them, and said, you know, just take these when you have a headache. And he just waited for her to take the killing capsule, which she eventually did. So Howe eventually, in the appeals process, he defended this medical student, a guy named Carlisle Harris. And the initial trial had been, you know, one of these, even though trials went faster, I think this one lasted a couple weeks. Again, it was something that the newspapers were all over because, you know, middle-class victims, which also plays well today, you know, the uniqueness of the killing method and so on and so forth. And in fact, the prosecutor was a guy named William Travers Jerome, who was a cousin of Winston Churchill, which just goes to show, I mean, there's like 2 degrees of separation between Howe and Hummel and just about everyone. In the appeal, which William Howe takes, the tack he takes is to attack the victim, Helen Potts, and he accuses her of being a morphine addict, and he clearly pays people to come up with affidavits, essentially to malign her character. And I have to say, yeah, zealous advocacy, but this mm-hmm. seemed to me, yeah. I don't know, what do you think? This seemed to me to really
disgusting.
Cross the line.
Yeah, it was disgusting. And I think he used that, and, you know, he clearly used that technique a lot, almost when he ran out of anything else to say.
Which, again, appealing, you probably see all the time.
Yes and no. I don't think lawyers aren't allowed to get away with it in the same in the same to the same degree.
Okay.
And character evidence now is much more regulated by law or by, you know, rules of evidence. Especially, clearly, the defendant's character, you have to open the door for it. He seemed to do that a lot, too. Be able to get away with bolstering his clients. But really what shocked me was the appeals to... you know, and I'd like you to talk to me about this, too, because I was fascinated by this. You know, as I said to you when we first started emailing, wow, these guys really were the reason I had to take an ethics bar. You know, like, wow. And you know, and why I need regular ethics credits, you know, because these guys really did cross the line. So I'm not commending their their methodology, but I just thought it was an interesting question that if you kind of read this book as a zealous advocate, where do you draw the line? The appealing to God, that and telling the jury, if you convict, you will not sleep at night. Yeah. If you convict, you will go to hell?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
He pretty much saved that for capital cases, you know, which, I mean, there, if you're condemning someone to death, that's clearly a, and these days, murder conviction, you know, did often lead to the death penalty, and fairly quickly. It could happen in a matter of weeks, more likely months. So if you're a jury in a capital case and you find the person guilty, it, you know, it's an act of moral consequence. And he wanted to make sure that, that they knew it, and he would consistently tell them, you know, are you going to be able to sleep? Are you going to be able to live with yourself? In the case of men, in many a case, the jury clearly shrugged and said, yeah. Murderous women very rarely got convicted of first-degree murder and executed. The jurors would typically find some other way to convict, you know, second-degree murder. They just couldn't put women to the chair, which I thought was interesting.
In the murder triangle we were discussing before, she was convicted of manslaughter.
Yeah.
She chopped her ex-boyfriend up. I mean,
I personally think that she was the brains behind the operation, but she talked, so that was a lot of the reason.
Right.
So she talked and she blamed the guy, and the prosecution was willing to cut a deal essentially for the testimony, which is something you must be familiar with.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it, 98%, I think, of cases end in some sort of disposition other than a trial? I that's a statistic I remember from law school. I don't know if that's accurate at this point.
You know, I enjoyed being in the company of these guys, you know, 100 years after their death. And if I had been in New York and needed a defense lawyer in this era, I probably would have hired them because they did have a pretty good record. I'm under no illusions that these were, you know, decent people. That said, I do think they actually forced the bar to raise its game in certain ways, and it forced lawmakers to be, a couple times they pointed out imprecisions in the law, one of which allowed them to get 300 people out of jail because of the defective indictments. And, you know, you don't have to like people to say, frankly, yeah, you need to raise your game. If you're going to be putting people away, then your indictments do need to be accurate.
Absolutely.
And I think it's not implausible, Cassie, that the likes of Howard Hummel, you know, were behind some of the early ethical training of the bar, because they were outrageous, seemed to be so, and people said, you know, we do have to draw a line somewhere.
Yeah.
And then that eventually made its way into legal training.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, we talk about the prosecution's role being to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, that's our burden. And, you know, you go into the room knowing it. And one of the lines I've employed in a closing is, this is my burden and I welcome it. They have absolutely every single right. The defendant sitting at that table has every single right to say, prove it. Let's put the evidence to the test. You want to find me guilty, prove it. And that's the system we're in.
But how do you feel, like, when William Howe in a case of the murderer of the so-called Castle Island lifesaver, who was a lifeguard down at the southern tip of Manhattan, and hot summer's day, he's drinking, and they get into a fight, actually, it's not in the middle of the fight that he's killed. It's in colder blood later on this hot day that his assailant keeps drinking, you know, his anger keeps festering, and then late that afternoon he goes after the so-called Castle Garden lifesaver with a gun, misses the first couple times and wings him the third. So there's clearly some premeditation here. It's not in the heat of the moment. And basically the defense is to attack the character of the victim and to bring in witnesses who are clearly just lying through their teeth. I mean,
obviously that's so wrong. I think that the fairness has to be in play. I mean,
even with the defense bar,
even with the defense bar, yeah. Absolutely. You know, as you said, I used the example earlier of the child. You know, why not rent a kid? That is that bad? But I think when it goes to misleading the jury,
right,
that's where the problems begin. You know, it's one thing to use
in the actual testimony.
Yes. Yeah. Oh God. Then that. Yeah. That. Yeah. But even I would say, you know, even the fake child, if the impression is,
yeah,
you know, that's for an argument. But especially in the testimony, everything that comes from that witness stand that they're allowed to rely on has to be the truth. It has to be fair. And I think that the system now strives for that.
Well, one of the issues in this era was that judges were elected, and it was the era of Tammany Hall in New York. So basically, judges were appendages of Tammany Hall, which was the political machine that ran New York for decades. And in fact, Howe and Hummel first came to prominence in the early 1870s when there was an investigation of four judges for corruption and general ineptitude.
Because this is where Cardozo comes
in. Exactly.
Right? Yes, okay.
And, you know, the idea that judges were corrupt, I think today would be systematically corrupt. I think today would be, you know, very shocking. In the early 1870s, it was more or less a shrug. Everyone knew that the judges were Tammany hacks, essentially. But basically, it clearly just hit a level that it couldn't be ignored anymore. It just smelled too much. And the New York State Legislature appoints a commission to investigate the judges, and lo and behold, they actually investigate the judges. It's the kind of thing New York City would have been incapable of doing because it was also political. So four judges in particular are investigated. One of them, Albert Cardozo, who is the father of the great Supreme Court jurist, Benjamin Cardozo. And it turns out that Cardozo was a particular friend of Howe and Hummel. And in something like 300 cases, he had sold them writs of habeas corpus, essentially just letting his clients out of jail, and then they were never tried for their crimes. And so Howe and Hummel are in this commission's proceedings. They're mentioned in the newspapers as being in the pocket, or filling the pocket, actually, of Albert Cardozo. In the event, they themselves are never put under any scrutiny. The New York City Bar Association has actually been founded specifically for this, to lift the status of the legal profession in the wake of this commission and so on, and in large part because of Howe and Hummel. But there really is no recourse at this point against really bad lawyers. That you can be disbarred, as each of them was at least once, but apparently you can buy your way back in.
Is that how they did it? I wasn't sure about that. Fascinating.
I'm just assuming.
Me. Right.
Yeah. You know, there's nothing on the record of, but yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how they did it. I can't imagine how else. And, you know, there was no formal ethical training or anything. So it was a very fluid era.
I think even now, you know, you have ethical training, you have ethical requirements, you have character and fitness interviews even to get past the bar. But in large part, people are who they are. And, you know,
I mean, you look at character and fitness interviews, and then you look at some of these clowns, and it's like, tough interview. You know?
It's like, what happened?
What happened? Exactly. I have no doubt Howard Hummel could have aced any character in this interview in a heartbeat.
Right. Absolutely. But you still have the same sort of penalties, I guess. There's disbarment, there's censure, and ultimately there's prison. I heard in an interview that you were giving, or read in an interview you gave with respect to this book, that your take is that New York City's gotten a lot better. You know, the police force, obviously. I mean, there was an all-out war between the two police forces during this era.
Right.
I don't think we're facing that imminently anymore.
Right. And I've been fortunate. I've recently gotten to know a woman who's a criminal court judge in New York. So I've been asking this woman about her experiences, and she's read the book. And clearly the judicial system is much less politicized than it was. I mean, you don't have to be in the hip pocket of whoever's mayor. And not to say that there's not a political element, of course,
sure.
But you don't have to pay obeisance to a political machine. The quality of people who become judges is much, much higher. Like, they are, in fact, all lawyers.
I think it depends on the lawyer you ask.
Yes, in general. Right. It's not to say everyone's absolutely perfect, but you didn't really have to have any legal background to become a judge. If you're a loyal Tammany person and there was an opening, and so you could get it. And clearly the police force today is just so much more professional and competent and honest than it was back in this day. One of the interesting moments in this period, not unlike the judicial system, everyone knows that the police force is, you know, spattered through with corruption, you know, small and large. Small being peddlers having to pay off cops and things like that. And there's a certain level of this, you know, sort of like a low-grade vaccination that people are willing to tolerate. But every once in a while, it just gets to be too much. And this happens in the mid-1890s when something called the Lexo Commission is again appointed by Albany, because New York City is incapable of policing itself in this way because it's so political. And they have appointed the Lexo Commission to investigate corruption in the New York City Police Department. And then, and in fact, they do so over a period of several months. They interview several hundred witnesses. They have a kind of a prosecutorial bent to it. The lead prosecutor, so to speak, you know, he looks like some biblical patriarch. And out of it comes 5,000 of the most appalling pages you'll ever read about the inner workings of a great city. It's really quite shameful and sometimes kind of heartbreaking. Howard Hummel are not part of the Lexo Commission, but their name comes through it time and time again. You know, one of the whorehouses whose madam was a client, she was shaken down for the cops for $30,000. And things like that. So they kept, you know, they were just such a presence in the city. It's mm-hmm. It's hard to describe any incident of note in which they weren't in some way a vestigial character. Anyway, interestingly, in the wake of the Lexo Committee, New York gets a new police commissioner, a man by the name of Theodore Roosevelt, and it's really a very important moment in his career.
You know, you read the papers now. I don't know how familiar you are with the Daily News and New York Post coverage.
Oh, absolutely. But, New York Post is a guilty pleasure.
It really is, yeah. Right? But, you know, there's an investigation going on now, an integrity investigation.
Yeah, right. You know. I think the difference is, I mean, New York City has something like 35,000 police officers.
Yep.
They're not all going to be Eagle Scouts. I think the difference is the weight that the, you know, certainly in the 1880s, early 1890s, I think corruption was almost universal. I think it was literally difficult to be an honest cop, in part because your superiors were expecting to get kickbacks from your own graft.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of pressure from above for you to be extorting people below you. And I certainly don't think that's the case in any way, shape, or form.
You did mention, you know, Howe and Hummel, this police investigation, 2 degrees of separation. There seems to be about 1 degree of separation between Howe and Hummel and Amherst College. And I feel I would be remiss if we didn't discuss how Howe and Hummel are 1 degree separated from Amherst College.
Okay, well, one great example is a gentleman by the name of Charles Parkhurst, who was one of New York City's reformers in the 1880s and 90s. He was a minister in a church on Madison Avenue in the 30s, and he got up one day and it was in high dudgeon about corruption and vice in New York City and how Tammany Hall was complicit in it and so were the cops and so on. Anyway, the next day, all the newspapers said, you know, who is this guy? Show us the evidence. Well, he didn't actually have any evidence. It was like, you know, show me the evidence of oxygen. So he actually gets a private detective and a friend, and he gets the private detective to show him some of the worst dives and vice dens in New York City. And a month later, he gets back to the pulpit and he's waving affidavits and he says, here's the evidence that you asked for. Anyway, his name was Charles Parkhurst, and he began this group called the Society for the Suppression of Vice, I think. And was I think the, for the prevention of crime. Yeah.
Oh, in Afghanistan, it's called the Taliban.
Yeah. No, that's Comstock. Parkhurst, right. I think, is a good guy. It's their work that eventually led to the Lexow Commission. So Charles Parkhurst, Amherst man, he actually lived in Williamstown for a while, which I think we'll have to overlook. But I actually think he was, a pretty good guy. You know, he wasn't a hypocrite. The connection between sort of vice and corruption in New York City, you know, it was there, and it really hurt the city in a lot of ways in terms of paying off the cops, who would then turn a blind eye to things considerably more serious than, you know, your neighborhood whorehouse. Parkhurst was married, and he is very concerned about vice, which essentially means prostitution. You could certainly argue there's other kinds of vice, like, you know, hideous working conditions and slumlords and so on. That was not his thing. Basically, sex was. But at one point, a number of working women come to his house and they say, "You're putting us out of work, and we've got families to raise." And, you know, he said, "You know, fair point." And he and his wife took in a couple of them. They tried to find jobs for the rest. I have a real soft spot for Charles Parkhurst. And anyone who tried to clean up New York in the late 1880s, early 1890s, they deserve some sympathy.
Absolutely. I did not realize that Parkhurst was an Amherst grad. I was actually thinking of Henry Ward Beecher.
Well, Henry Ward Beecher, another great figure of the era. It just shows that, you know, Amherst is only 1 or 2 degrees of separation from most things. And in fact, a little off the point, one of my favorite stories relating to Amherst was that my friends and I used to say, you know, the great thing about Amherst is that even though it's not that big, you seem to always be able to find an Amherst grad somewhere. And so I was saying, yeah, if I'm ever at the climbing Mount Everest, I'm going to, you know, go up there and I'm going to wear an Amherst t-shirt, and no doubt I'll run into someone. As it happens, a couple of friends of mine, after they graduated, they went to Texas, and they were part of some prison reform project in which a judge had required Texas prisons to make certain changes. And so their job was to go into the prisons and interview people, and then do things like, you know, measure the square footage of the cells to make sure that the orders were being followed. So Mike goes into this Texas prison, and he's, you know, got his measuring thing out, and, you know, Mike looks preppy, and the prisoner starts razzing him and says, you know, "Hey there, Ivy League, you know, how'd you land in a place like this?" And you know, similar sort of raillery. Eventually Mike, you know, gets sick of it and says, "I didn't go to the Ivy League." And the prisoner says, "Well, where did you go?" And Mike says, "Well, Amherst College." And the prisoner says, "No kidding, class of 56.
No!
I hasten to say the prisoner was in on a white-collar crime.
That might be your next book. Amherst grads who've gone to prison.
Oh, but anyway, Henry Ward Beecher was an Amherst grad. He was a notable figure in New York in the 1860s and 70s. He was a celebrity preacher. He was well known for his abolitionist point of view. I mean, he'd get thousands of people to listen to him preach. He was, in fact, something of a hypocrite, however. He liked women, and they didn't have to be his wife. In the early 1870s, these two sisters, flaky but rather fascinating, Victoria Woodhull and Tennessee Claflin, they know that Beecher's having an affair. And essentially, to boost the circulation of their struggling magazine, they out Beecher as an adulterer. Beecher does not sue them, you know, knowing that the accusations are in fact true, but he lets everyone else carry the water to defend his reputation, including a guy named Anthony Comstock, who gets the feds to charge the sisters with sending obscenity through the mail for accusing Beecher of adultery in these pages. Believe me, there is nothing obscene about this 12,000-word article. I almost wish there was. I read the entire thing. It's just incredibly tedious. But the point is, they are charging one of America's most famous and respected people with adultery, and they're charged with obscenity for doing so. Long story, Howe and Hummel are their lawyers. They eventually get off. Beecher's reputation doesn't really, because Woodhull and Claflin are such flakes, his reputation doesn't suffer. But it does a couple years later, when the husband of the woman he's been seeing, sues him for alienation of affections. It becomes one of the great, maybe the first great sex scandal of the American mass media. I mean, literally pages, inside pages of the papers are just the transcript of the trial and so on. Debbie Applegate wrote a very good book about Henry Ward Beecher and the trial.
She won the Pulitzer for that?
Yes, she did.
She did, right?
Yeah.
I actually was looking at that this morning and I thought, what a great book to read. But that hearing you say that about the pages of the newspaper being taken up at the trial reminds me of while I was in college or just after, the Clinton scandal, and sitting on the porch with friends of mine, Amherst friends of mine, just pouring through the newspapers, reading line by line by line. I mean, yeah. It's just history repeating itself.
Yeah. Yeah, the proximity of sex and power is apparently an enduring connection.
And as we started this interview, that's what's sexy about, you know, that's what sells.
Yeah, sex and crime.
Crime, it's yes.
It still works.
Mm-hmm.
It still works.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about how, as prosecutor, because wasn't there a case in which, not only, there were two things that struck me, the closing argument.
Right.
The summation, and there was a case he put together.
Yeah, there's a couple of cases in which they acted as private prosecutors. The most famous one, so what you could do is you could ask a private attorney to bring a private prosecution, and they would go to a level of court, I don't know if this still exists, in which a judge would evaluate the arguments and decide whether there was enough to bring a formal prosecution. So it was like a warm-up. If you could make the case before this judge, then the DA would take it up.
Would take it.
And so this, it's one of my favorite stories in the book, because it says a lot about Howe and Hummel as lawyers and in their time. There was a spiritualist who was essentially taking an old man for his money. Her name was Editha Distabar, and her mark was a guy named Luther Parker, who was a lawyer. He'd been a judge. He was a city parks commissioner. He'd been a law partner of Noah Webster, another Amherst connection, and a all-around good guy. But his wife had died a couple years earlier, and poor Luther is lonely. He comes into the orbit of the spiritualist, who eventually moves in with her so-called husband and children, and proceeds to basically asset strip him. She eventually gets the mortgage to his townhouse. At this point, Luther's friends step in. I mean, they can see what's happening. Everyone but Luther can see what's happening. And they ask, Luther's lawyer friends ask Howe and Hummel to bring a private prosecution so that they can get the spiritualist before a criminal court. And what I think is interesting about that, this happens in 1886, it's interesting that essentially in a jury of their peers, Howe and Hummel are the ones asked to do this. So clearly they do have at least the professional respect of a good number of their peers who pay them to do this. The second interesting thing is that Howe and Hummel do a really good job in this case. I mean, everyone likes Luther. No one wants to... I mean, he's being, you know, humiliated as well as impoverished by this woman. And, you know, they want to help him without humiliating him in public. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Howe and Hummel do a really good job of investigating the case, cross-examination, bringing in magicians to show how the spiritualist, you know, produces some of her effects. And yet they do it with a kind of a gentle touch so that, you know, Luther is not made to seem any more ridiculous than he in fact is. And I think it's, anyway, so I it's one of my sort of favorite cases in the book. And they eventually win, and she is prosecuted and convicted, spends little time in prison, and then actually goes off and does the same thing to someone else at the end of it, as often happens with con people, as I'm sure you see all the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
does he get it out? Does Luther end up with the assets back?
He does. She actually gives back the mortgage when she hears there's going to be a private prosecution, hoping that it will go away. And by the end of the trial, Luther realizes she's not a good woman. He still believes in spiritualism, but he evicts her husband, who's not her husband. He already has a wife and kids from the house. He actually ends up taking up with another spiritualist, but the second one isn't quite so awful, and eventually Luther dies, and you know, he doesn't die impoverished. But it does make you just think. You can kind of see in the heat of the moment stuff happens. But these con women, you know, the relentlessness, the way they went after this poor, lonely old man's assets, there was something truly evil about that.
Right, and you have, it's slow, it's like a weed. I mean, it gets, for them to be good at their job, they have to manipulate, they have to take the time.
She was living with him, yeah. So you're doing it 24 hours a day. And she tries to bring someone else into the plot, and a theater impresario, and he's no angel, and he just turns away in disgust and eventually becomes a prosecution witness.
Yeah.
You know, he says it's something to the effect, he has no problem with easy money, but this was going too far.
Yeah. It's interesting, there's a sort of moral limit even in the world of thieves, but you know, and perhaps we should stop now, but that speaks to, you know, the bank robbers. And they're sort of they're the highbrow thieves of the era. But they're, in some ways, you think of that as more a victimless crime. You know, I mean, granted, you're stealing money that belongs to someone else, and ultimately they are impoverished. Yeah. But because there's that separation between the human being who is directly affected and, you know, as compared to the Luther figure or...
Yeah. Well, bank robbers really were the aristocrats of time, of the time. And regarded as such, you know, by the cops, who clearly had a sneaking regard for them. I mean, they were very sophisticated, you know, developing, you know, and crafting their own tools and so on. And in fact, one of the interesting cases in the era takes place in Northampton. So that's a quasi-Amherst connection in which this gang of burglars burgles the Northampton Savings Bank. But to do so, they also have to tie up the cashier, so there's a victim, and mostly they're nonviolent because they know violence will bring a lot more attention down the line. Mm-hmm. And what they normally do is the burglars will, obviously they'll keep the cash and jewels, but any kinds of securities they'll essentially ransom back. So the banks have very little interest in prosecuting these guys. Howe and Hummel were naturally the lawyers for all the really good burglars in the era.
Thank you so much. This is I could go on for another
hour.
Well,
I just, you know, I really wish I had heard more of your stories. So, but thanks. This was fun.
Thank you. Absolutely. Yeah. This has been great. Okay.